past 2 p.m. Another beautiful Tuesday out there. Attorney Brad Young joins us. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Dave.
So, Rach, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with your question to me yesterday and get a better answer?
Sure. Brad, I was just noticing, you know, the story about the White House Correspondents' Dinner shooter is entering a plea of not guilty. And I'm looking at the situation going, this person is clearly guilty of attempting to assassinate someone. We all have access to all of this information showing that's what he was intending on doing. So why in that case plead not guilty?
That's a great question. And it requires me to kind of break it down how these things work. So what happens is in a criminal prosecution or a defense criminal defense case, what you want to do is to knock out as many of the charges as you possibly can, because prosecutors often do what's called overcharging. They charge with as much as they can dream up to charge a defendant. So as a defendant's attorney, you want to plead not guilty for your client, but also knock out as many of those charges as you can. And like a part of it here in this case is that Cole Allen is also alleging that there's a conflict of interest with Jeanine Pirro and also the attorney general. And so at that point, you want to block them from being involved. Is that going to change anything? No, but it drags the case on. It causes some the Department of Justice to do more work and effort. So through that process, the strategy is create some chaos in the prosecution, lower the number of charges by getting some of them dismissed, and then you plea bargain or try to plea bargain down when you have the remaining charges that are going to stick. So that's the overall strategy in a defense case.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe I was just thinking of things too literally. I guess you're not actually saying, like, I'm not guilty at all. It's more saying I'm not going to play nice with the situation as it stands.
Same, prove it.
Right.
Exactly. Because it's the state's job to prove it. And so people almost always, no one, I'm sure someone has, but the vast, vast majority of all defendants plead not guilty so that they can go through that process that I just outlined for you.
And Brad, you mentioned that prosecutors oftentimes like to overcharge and just kind of see what sticks. Does that ever end up hurting the prosecution or in any way? Or is it just like, well, we can try it. It's not going to be a big deal.
No, it really does hurt them. And let me give you a brief example of how it can hurt them. So if a prosecutor throws out five charges against a defendant, you know, one through five, five being the most severe, one being the least severe, and they throw all those out there, and let's assume that they all stick. Now, when that case goes to a jury, the jury, if the jury feels sympathetic towards the defendant, then they can find him or her guilty of the least significant charge. And so therefore the prosecutors can actually be harmed by overcharging. And that's why even a lot of times you'll see prosecutions where they overcharge defendants, and then right before trial, they'll dismiss some of the charges because they don't want the jury to find him guilty of a misdemeanor if they being the prosecution thinks that they have the evidence to convict the defendant on a felony charge.
Brad, question. If I shoot Wheeler for not being nice enough about Casey's Pizza,
yep,
and I'm charged, and I hire you as my attorney, and I say, look, Brad, I did it. I'm not going to play any games. I want to plead guilty at my arraignment. Are you even allowed to?
I think you could be allowed to, but I wouldn't be representing you by that point.
Yeah, can you flesh that out?
Well, sure, because everything in the legal system revolves around leverage. What do I mean by leverage? Leverage is I have something that you want. That's what leverage is in a nutshell. So the prosecution wants you, Dave Glover, to plead guilty. So I'm going to make them pay for it. What I mean by pay for it? I'm going to make them give me the least significant charge. So it's not going to be murder. We're going to plead this down, even though you might have lots of motive, malice aforethought to kill Wheeler. In essence, we're going to do is we're going to say, well, it was from the height of passion. So really it's a manslaughter charge because it wasn't premeditated. So what the state wants to do is to get from us a guilty plea. If you give it up too soon, that's like walking into a car dealership and paying sticker. All right. You don't want to do that if you can get that same car for a less price, or if you can end up pleading guilty for a lesser charge.
And Brad, let's say that I am convicted and I'm given the death sentence, and we know it's going to take 20, 25 years to get me to the needle. Do you believe that maybe we've gone a little over the top with due process when it comes to that function of the courts?
It's not so much due process, but I used to be a very strong proponent of the death penalty, and I've changed. Why? I still feel the same way, but there's only two reasons to support the death penalty. And this is in case law even. And one is deterrent, right? If we execute Dave Glover for shooting Wheeler, then that may keep, you know, Mark Reardon from shooting Fred Bottomer, okay? So deterrence is number one. Second is making sure that justice aligns with the charge or with the what they were convicted of. But when you're on in death row for 20 years, that negates both of the arguments for the death penalty. It takes so long, it's not really justice if it takes 25 years to go forward with the execution. And it's not a deterrent because a guy's going to know, hey, worst thing that can happen is I get 20 years of free meals. It's not going to be a deterrent. So if the death penalty doesn't meet either of those rationale for doing it, I'm not sure that it has any purpose other than emotional revenge type of a feeling, which is not the purpose of the death penalty at all.
Very interesting. Let's talk about the Netflix case. I don't know much about it. I just know that Texas has filed suit against Netflix, making some pretty dark allegations.
Well, I find this interesting because right now we've got all of these lawsuits against Meta and against YouTube, and they're arguing that it's Instagram. And the arguments are, and some of them have prevailed up to this point, not on appeal, but at the trial level, by saying this product is designed to addict my kid. That's what it's designed to do. And so therefore, it's not negligence. It's not a design flaw. It's an intentional harm because you're trying to get my kids addicted to watching social media. Well, Texas is using that same argument against Netflix by saying the way that, you know, if you click I like this or if you watch something on Netflix, it will give you more options for something that you like. So Texas is making the argument here with Netflix, just like other plaintiffs have done against Meta and social media platforms, by saying you're trying to get my kid addicted to watching cheap teen romance movies, and my kid's addicted to that because of you, Netflix. And so we're going to make you pay not only money, but we want you to be enjoined or prevented from using those algorithms when my kid's watching TV.
Do those types of arguments have a standing? I mean, because people have been watching TV on the regular for 50 years, and every show is designed to keep you watching. And you know, back in the day, the NBC Thursday night lineup, when it was Friends and it was Seinfeld, like the whole idea was we're trying to keep you on our station.
Right. But it's general versus specific. OK, you know, on the Friends Thursday night lineup that everyone who's going to be 20 something or 30 something is going to watch it. But they don't know that Kevin Wheeler is going to be watching.
Mm-hmm.
And this is different. The theory is different because it's not just we're trying to appeal to teenage girls who want to watch teen romance stuff. We're zeroing in on Alicia because we know that her parents subscribe to Netflix and she likes this stuff. So it goes from the general to the specific. And I think that's the allegation that makes sense when it comes to Meta. At least legally. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just pointing out the legality
of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Texas is trying to do. Now, at the end of the day, I don't think that they're going to win on this case. I mean, I think Netflix is going to be able to get rid of this addiction and autoplay part of the case and just narrow it towards other areas of the litigation, because there's just not a lot of evidence that Netflix is addictive in the same way that social media is addictive.
Yeah, Brad will be curious to see what kind of evidence Texas has on the allegation that Netflix is, you know, surveilling their customers and building these sales profiles that they're then turning around and selling to other companies, especially because they say, you know, Netflix claimed they weren't interested in doing that, and yet now they are doing that. I'm just interested to see the evidence on that.
Yeah, and I think, Rachel, I think that part of this case is actually going to probably work in Texas's favor, because they can show that Netflix bragged about not sharing your data.
Right.
And then through subpoenas, they can get evidence that they are sharing the data. Mm-hmm. So that part of the litigation, I think, will most likely be successful, maybe into the point of getting a plea bargain here out of Netflix. Where I think it's less likely to be successful is showing that they're addicting teenagers with Netflix, because in reality, it's easier to catch that than it is social media. I mean, the parents mm-hmm. can just terminate Netflix. They can see when they go into Netflix what the kids are watching. And I just think that that is going to be tougher for the state to prove.
I'm wondering if any of you guys can think of another example that's kind of a bait and switch like these tech companies do to us, which is they offer a service. A lot of times the service is free. Obviously, in Netflix's case, you're paying a subscription. But, you know, Meta, Twitter, all of these places, they're offering you a service, but then they're just compiling, you know, this profile on you and then turning around and selling your data. Is there any other industry that you guys can think of that is allowed to do stuff like that? Where it's like, oh yeah, we happen to know all of this about you because you're consuming our product. Now we're selling it to someone else. When the consumer is going in, like, not even thinking that this is going to happen.
I mean, it's very clearly an internet thing, right? I mean, that's how you can search something on Amazon, and the next second you look at it, it's your banner on ESPN.
It's also, I guess it's not, I started to say it's surprising, but it's kind of the opposite of surprising, that we have all just sort of gone, okay.
Well, because we went into it not understanding what was happening, and then when you learn about it after the fact, it's harder to be like, oh my gosh, I don't consent to this. Well, I've already been consenting
somewhere, right,
to it.
Brad? It's in those terms, and we all click yes.
Right.
And I even click yes. Sure, I don't read that crap.
I'm sure it's in there somewhere, so we're all, I mean, again, but it's the practicality. Who's going to read all that
and
fully grasp it?
And then also, you know, if Texas is successful in this lawsuit, so then what? Netflix pays like $1 billion tops. They won't pay that much, but they'll just pay it and then they'll continue to do it. It seems like we should have a lot harsher penalties for the whole bait and switch thing, but we don't.
Well, there would be. I think in this case, Rachel, that any settlement would involve not just the payment of money, but would also involve an injunction, or really what's called a consent judgment, where Netflix would agree that they will stop conducting these types of activities. I think from Texas' standpoint, that's more important than money. Now, if this were a class action lawsuit, it's always about the money because that's how the lawyers get paid. But from a state, from a government entity's perspective, they don't care so much about the money. They're paying lawyers anyway. They're more looking for the what's called the equity part of the case, which is to stop Netflix from doing that.
All right. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it, Brad.
My pleasure, guys.
So, Wheels and I both have new things from the Sean Duffy. Spent 8 months with his wife, who's a Fox News lady, and their 8 kids traveling across America, shooting a show. He didn't get paid for it, but all the sponsors are very recognizable. You know, like transportation companies who want favors with the administration, things like that. I just think it's absurd that anyone with a real job could just take 7 months out of their first year and not do their job. But especially, you ass clown, when planes are landing on trucks and people and DHS, like the TSA, like, come on. How ridiculous are you? And my piece of it is that he and his wife are defending the show, saying that anyone who has a problem with this, it's because of two reasons. The show is too wholesome and too patriotic.
How would I even know that if I haven't seen it?
That's their defense.
Yeah. I saw a defense of that, saying, look, they weren't on the road for 7 months. They were on the road for several weekends during a seven-month period. Regardless, you should be spending your time doing your job. I mean, how mad would sports fans be if you found out that during the season, one of your players was missing any time at all?
Yeah.
Missing a game to go do some music thing or to go do some other thing. You'd be like, what? No, not okay. But of course, you know, secretary's okay. Now, the story I saw today is Politico's got a story. They found the pitch profile for the show, like what they're giving to sponsors and potential sponsors. And there are various levels. And with the higher you go, the more, quote, access to networking you get with Sean Duffy. So if you're a transportation company that wants to spend $1 million, you get more access to the transportation secretary.
We're just breaking laws openly now.
I mean, come on.
I mean, when I was in law school, we were taught, hammered into our heads, none of you are ever going to commit an ethical violation. That's not our worry. Our worry is that you'll have the appearance of impropriety. Right. And we're all like, I don't want that. And then now we're just like, hey, if you pay $1 million, we're going to go to lunch and I might introduce. It's like, come on.
So here, there's more to it than what I'm going to read. I'm just going to pick out that part that's about access, because if you're a platinum partner starting at $1 million for the Great American Road Trip, you get, you know, various promotional, like you get signage, you get, you know, banners on the page, whatever. You're like, you know, that's normal stuff. But also, you get up to 6 VIP invitations to receptions, roundtables, and networking events. Reserve seating at road trip activations. In other words, access to the transportation secretary if you want to spend $1 million.
Everything about this is just wrong. It just is. I mean, and it's the least of our worries. We have 22-foot gold statues. Like, but it's just so on brand. It's so par for this administration.
Yeah. Yep. And this is the kind of thing that if you're a normal working person and you're like, I can do this side thing, but it will not take away time from my work. And the boss would probably be like, okay, but your work better not slip. Yeah. And there better not be any problems. It's not like the whole transportation world is just going smooth.
No. No.
Not blaming that on him, by the way, but it's still his job to fix things and make things work.
Yes. Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Happy Tuesday to you. Time to talk to your pal, Ricky Horton. Hello, Rick.
Happy Tuesday to you guys.
So, Rick, we know the record and how the guys have done, and very pleased so far, but how has the West Coast trip just been so far, just overall?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, it was really fun in San Diego, and kind of hard to not have fun in San Diego. I mean, you know, you don't want to always just kind of go to the weather in terms of talking about what the trip is like, but you know, it really was nice. And of course, Mother's Day, there were some guys that had some cool things to say about their moms for our broadcast on Sunday, and getting to stay that extra day in San Diego on Monday before coming here to Sacramento. And Sacramento, it's gorgeous here too, and it's my first look at this new ballpark too. And many of the players have not been here. Now, Joel Pozo played here for 4 years, but it's going to be new for a lot of us.
It's a fascinating thing, isn't it, Rick, to play major league games in a minor league ballpark and in an environment, by the way, that is incredibly friendly to offense.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that turns out in terms of the Cardinals' offense. I'd love to see the first four guys in the Cardinals' order just go crazy here in this ballpark. But so it kind of has a, you know, I walked around, my son's visiting from L.A., so he and I walked around the ballpark this afternoon, went for a nice long walk down by the river and around the stadium here. And, you know, I feel like it has a feel a little bit of spring training when you play in a minor league ballpark, and because that's kind of what it's like. But you know, as I told my son, there were a couple parks back in the day. It was Atlanta and Pittsburgh. When you got to the ballpark, you had to remind yourself, this counts today. So don't get lulled into sleep here and thinking that this is not the big leagues, because it is.
Yeah, you don't want to get lulled to sleep facing that Oakland lineup, though. They have some pitching questions, but they can hit the ball over the fence.
Yeah, they can, and it's going to be a good series for that. They're in first place in the West, and you know, they're not like they're gangbusters, but they're a couple games over 500, I think, last I checked. And so, you know, it'll be interesting. They got a guy throwing a bunch of changeups today, so we'll see if our guys can handle that.
Yeah, tough lefty Jeffrey Springs. That'll be Andre Pallante for the Cards. Ricky, the rotation has been significantly better about the last, what, two and a half times through the through the mix. And, you know, the first part of the year, that was a struggle, and the offense was kind of carrying it. It's kind of reversed here in the last week and a half.
Yeah, the ebbs and flows of the baseball season.
Yeah.
We see that every year, and now it's, you know, the pitching's great, and the hitting is, you know, if the hitting would have been able to, they would have been able to push two or three more runs across. Maybe you win three out of four. Maybe you win four out of four in San Diego. That was very possible. Of course, the pitching for San Diego had something to do with that. But Cardinals starters have an ERA under three during that time frame you mentioned, about 2.5 times through the rotation. So, and actually, in the long run, I think you're better off when your starting pitchers are doing that, because that eventually will help the bullpen get better and, you know, just score enough runs to win. I think the recipe in baseball still, to me, and I, you know, not that I don't care about offense, but it's still pitching and defense. If you can pitch it and catch it, you're going to at least be in every game.
Question for you guys. I'm all of us fans are trying to understand the rebuild, because we just, I mean, we probably have done it in the Cardinals past, but we haven't talked about it so openly. And I'm trying to get a hold on how much cover players have during this season, and not to pick on him, I love Victor, but kind of, you know, taking him as an example, like, is he covered through the end of the year, or are they going to look at it and go, I think we've seen what we need to see?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I think the way it kind of is now, I think when you're in this rebuild state, let's call it that, and you might, others may use a different word, but that's really what it is. But I think you just kind of let people play, and you don't really make a decision too knee-jerk. And when I say too knee-jerk, no, he's not hitting right now, but he might be hitting in 3 weeks. He might be hitting in a month. And then, but there's not like this pressure to say, boy, if we lose the next 2 weeks of games because we've got two guys that are struggling, that ruins our season. You don't have that kind of, you know, sword hanging over your head.
Yeah,
you just don't. And so you're, it's not that you can't logically make the statement that, you know, we could use another bat. Okay, you could say that. But is that really the answer that fits what we're doing? And I think what it really comes down to is all of the people working with all of our pitchers and hitters, and including Brant Brown working with Victor Scott, is what as long as we feel like he's developing, and not, there's no real results to it right now, but does it mean that he's not working at it? And so you give him every chance in the world to develop, and just as the Cardinals have done with Jordan Walker, and eventually, you know, the light switch came on for him, and you hope that it will for Victor.
Yeah, so to answer your question, Dave, when it comes to Victor Scott, a lot of it's about when Lars Nootbaar comes back and what it looks like.
Yeah.
Right? And Ollie was talking about this on Gashouse Gang today with the guys, with Bernie and Tom and Ranj. He didn't get specific. He's not going to, but just, Newt's probably 3 weeks, 4 weeks away from being back. And if Nathan Church is going the way he's been really good. I mean, really, what, Ricky, since about 2 weeks into the season, 3 weeks, and since then, he's been really good, and Walker's great, and they're going to play Newt. I mean, Newt's not coming up here to be a bench guy, so that's when the timing, the crunch might fit when it comes to the outfield.
I would be stunned if it's not another 3 or 4 weeks for Newt.
I might
be
he's
wrong
not on
that,
a rehab assignment yet, and he's got to go on a 20, 30 day or 20?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how many days it is, and I'm not sure when it's going to start, but it's going to be 4 weeks out before we see him. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And so you make the decision when you get closer to that. And so if you make a decision now, you don't, you're going to bring up a guy that's going to hit 150 that's hitting in AAA. That doesn't get you anywhere. And so you want to make sure that you've got a viable solution, or you could say, well, we'll go out and buy somebody that costs $10 million to play. No, that's not going to happen. So basically you're just giving the guy a chance until there's a better option. I think your answer is the right answer.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see too. Not just that one, but even other ones, you know, as the season goes along, because right now that's the big one. But one thing you can lean into for the time being, because you don't have Newt as an option, is that Victor Scott's going to play great center field. And, that's kind of what you're hoping for. The hard part is if you have two or three guys not hitting at the bottom of the order, now it gets a little tougher. And that's kind of what it was in San Diego, Ricky, because Pajes is in a bit of a slump and Scott's not hitting, and it kind of makes it tough because you don't get any turnover to the top of the order.
So here's another way to look at it. What team in baseball doesn't have two or three guys at the bottom of the order not hitting?
Right now, a lot, I mean, probably what, 25 teams are like that?
Yeah. Hey, the Dodgers have a guy in their leadoff spot that's not hitting, but I think they're going to find a way for him. Now, I'm not saying that Victor Scott's going to be Shohei Ohtani, but the point is, there's a lot of struggling veteran players in baseball right now. You think about all the really star-studded players. There's a lot of guys just kind of not getting it done right now. And again, I'm not putting Victor in that slot yet, but you know, just I think. Again, if there's not another option, I think you just stay with what you've got.
Is it just coincidence, Kyle Raleigh and all these guys that are just, you know, kind of on the schneid still? Like,
it happens every year. It's just different dudes. Does.
It's baseball. I mean, honestly, it's not a push button thing. It's not like, you know, every season is different. Like you come back to spring training. I used to remember this, Dave. I used to come to spring training and say, now, how did I hold that change up again? I used to get everybody out with, because you haven't thrown a baseball for 3 months back then. Mm-hmm. They do that now. But I want to get that, make sure I get that exact feel again, because that was the difference maker for me. And you had that little bit of, I hope I can find it, because this season's a new season. And I've got to, you know, kind of figure it out again. And sometimes you figure it out and sometimes it takes you a while to. Kyle Raleigh's going to be just fine eventually. But, you know, pitchers adjust to him, too. That's the other thing. They see, well, what's the best way to attack him? And they just go right there.
Well, let me be a total KMOX homer here. But what I'm learning from this season, sitting in my seat in the bleachers, is that I am very excited by the core of this team. And yes. I could see Mason, JJ, Gorman, Burleson, guys like that, leading us into the playoffs, maybe even next year, certainly the year after.
Yeah, so I was thinking a lot, again, about 1985, and I've mentioned this to you guys before, but 1984, we were in third place, not very good. We lost our best player, Bruce Sutter, Hall of Famer, and we had five guys, no-name guys in the bullpen that turned into a thing that worked. And we got better, and we kept getting better, and we kept getting better. And then we kind of added on. You get Cesar Cedeno to provide some pop. Now, there are other guys we got, too, Jack Clark. But the point is, you know, it can turn fast. And all of a sudden, the guys that you don't, you know, nobody was talking about Willie McGee and Terry Pendleton before they had that season. And then they kept talking about him. I mean, right. Willie, of course, had the year in 82, but he was still young. And, you know, everybody just had better years and they developed. And so you never know in the game. And that's, again, the beauty of it is guys can all of a sudden turn it on. On a dime, just again, as Jordan Walker did.
Yeah, that's the thing. This is a fun exercise. If Jordan Walker hadn't emerged, what's the record? Because I think he's a huge part. He's the piece you're missing, right? He's the all-star power hitter, right?
Who's hitting fourth if he's not?
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think he has been the straw stirring the drink for sure.
Yeah, and that's why the turnaround has faster than we thought, because an internal guy just blew up, and now he's hitting like an all-star. And, boy, in a year, if you have one more of those, whoever it happens to be, Joshua Baez, maybe it's Raniel Rodriguez, who just got moved to Double-A at 19.
Yes.
Because nobody can get him out in A-ball. Like, who knows how that works, but it's like those kind of things are what accelerate the process. This is accelerated not only, but in large part because of Walker.
And when you see somebody accelerate, and our 85 version would have been Jack Clark going from a really good outfielder to a 30 home run guy and 100 RBIs. So when we saw that, then other guys went from an okay pitcher to a pretty good eighth inning guy, or an infielder went from Tommy Herr went from a good player to a guy that drove 100 runs. I mean, everybody kind of went to their max, their better, which, you know, you hope what's going on with Jordan Walker will make Nolan Gorman find a better himself, and Mason Wynn and JJ Weatherholt. And I think Weatherholt's a big difference maker too, honestly. I mean, he's not hitting 300, eventually will, but he's still very important to this season.
Rick, have a great call tonight. We'll talk to you on Thursday.
Thanks, guys. Good to be with you.
Cardinals fans, this is Ricky Horton. Have you ever had a dream?
Welcome back, DGS and KMOX. A few minutes shy of 3 p.m. Andrew, I was thinking about you last night.
Thank you.
I bought you something, and it's been misplaced in my home. So 30 years from now, I'm going to be in full-blown dementia and find an extra-large Team Punch t-shirt.
What's Team Punch?
Team Punch.
Oh, Team Punch.
Team Punch.
What's Team Punch?
The monkey.
Oh.
Is that how I was supposed to react to the pizza?
Yes. Yes.
I'm shaking ass a little bit in case you're wondering.
Yes, the Wheeler corollary would have been for him to say, like, I guess I could wear that.
I hope it fits.
That sounds like something that would cover my body.
Actually, if it's just an extra large, no, sir.
Let's see what's going on with Punch these days.
I think Punch passed away.
No.
Oh.
He's
Why
still
would
there.
You say that?
What is it with you and like prematurely murdering people?
No kidding.
Peter Stormare and now Punch?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did do that. Yeah.
Oh, you didn't murder him, but announcing their untimely deaths. I'm guessing yeah. Punch is probably
is there
still
any
punching.
Punch news?
Not really news. People are just going to visit him at the zoo still.
It's kind of crazy how we do that with like little baby animals. Like Mudang. When was the last time anybody ever thought about Mudang?
Well, you called it. During your Punch phase, you said, in 3 weeks, I'm not going to care.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's not just me. No one's going to care because I've seen this so many times with like, you know, my little Instagram pets and stuff. Mm. I was the last fan of Little Bub when Little Bub died.
Who's Little Bub?
Little Bub was this messed up little cat freak who, like, I mean, he was like a.
His face was. He didn't look like a normal cat.
Yeah, he was like permanently small and his tongue hung out. I don't think he could see or smell or hear or anything. And so.
Sounds awful.
His owner paraded him out because he was cute and we all had to deal with Little Bub. I was obsessed with Little Bub. I love Little Bub so much and I was shattered when he died.
Oh, man. This slug from a New York Times story on Punch 3 days ago is the best.
You don't have to call Punch a slug.
No, that's the name of the story. It's a journalism thing.
I know.
Said the Punch, now 9 months old, has been attracting tens of thousands of visitors to the small Japanese zoo. He ignores the attention. he's a true superstar.
That's Punch for you.
He just ignores it. He's a true star. He's like Brad Pitt walking through, like, I'm not answering questions. I'm ignoring you.
I'll take Punch over pretty much every other celebrity we have today.
No, yeah.
Did you guys see the Zendaya thing?
No.
She means nothing to me. She's not my generation. I don't think I've ever seen her in anything. I don't hate her.
Oh, you haven't seen the Spider-Man movies?
No.
Oh.
But
you didn't watch Euphoria?
She showed up at a friend's wedding, which looked like is in like a little chapel, like in Vegas or something. And she showed up 20 minutes late, and it's all on video. And everyone's like, oh, my God, it's Zendaya. Oh, my God. And rather than her being like, chill, she's like, oh, what is her? So I just hate the celebrity. I just hate celebrity. I really have come to hate celebrity.
Well, that's tough, especially being a wedding. It's tough because it's supposed to be the bride's moment. So right. They always say, like, don't wear white. Don't try to look prettier than the bride or anything like that. Zendaya is going to be prettier than, like, any bride. Like, she is one of the most gorgeous women on the planet. So, like, the fact that she is ultra famous and she's just showing up at as herself 20 minutes late, like, yeah, it's kind of not maybe, like, the nicest move in the world for the bride to have that happen.
Like, don't you get enough attention? Is it just that?
I mean, I'm assuming like someone in the family said, like, will you please come in and it'll make their year if you come in. And I highly doubt she was like, oh, sure, I would love to come, like out of nowhere.
I mean, I know I'm just saying, like, I don't know if you guys know what celebrities are, but I saw Katy Perry the night of the Met Gala in some sort of a limo bus because she couldn't move because she's dressed like a robot. And she had her little face thing off and she was talking to her 8 handlers and she's like, no. I want you to read every single comment that people post about. And I'm like, God, you suck. You suck.
Yeah.
Give me Punch.
Give me Punch.
Well, helps that he can't say words.
Although, if you think.
I like Katy Perry a lot better if she didn't say words.
If you think, number one, Punch is showing up on time to that wedding. Or number two, the whole joint ain't shutting down when Punch walks in. You are incorrect, I think.